Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a journalist on food, health, and the environment, author of several books, and avid social media blogger, advocate, and activist on behalf of health and the environment. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of our habitat, planet Earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different authors, experts, thought leaders, and just all-around wise people about different facets of our total world and how we can make them better to promote health, life, and life on Earth. This week I have a very exciting show for you with a wonderful guest. We'll be coming to that shortly. But first I want to do a shout out, as I do during the first 5 or so minutes of every program, for a couple of actions or events. And this week we are featuring upcoming events that are very exciting that I wanted you to know about. First, we're going to be having a wonderful guest on our show in a couple of weeks' time. She's been on the show in the past. That's Helen Caldicott, Dr. Helen Caldicott, one of the premier nuclear activists and environmental activists of our time. For the last 30 years, she's really led the march on raising awareness about the dangers of nuclear power and seeking alternatives. Dr. Caldicott is having a wonderful symposium coming up in New York City for those in the Northeast region, and it will also be available on live stream for those who are not. The dates are the anniversary of the tragic Fukushima nuclear accident, March 11th and 12th, 2013, and the name of the symposium is The Medical and Ecological Consequences of That Event. This symposium will feature an international panel of leading medical and biological scientists, nuclear engineers, and policy experts who will discuss the biomedical and ecological consequences of Fukushima. It's going to be held in New York City at the New York Academy of Medicine on the 11th and 12th of March. You can also access it on live stream, and you can go to Dr. Caldicott's website, nuclearfreeplanet.org, in order to find out more details about participating in either way. You can also sign on for my eZine blog at healthjournalistblog.com or follow me on Facebook on Connecting the Dots for Health to receive upcoming announcements of when the show with Dr. Caldicott will be airing. So I have another event going on in New York City, and that will be taking place later in March. This will not be available on live stream. It's called Organizing 2.0, and it's for all of the people who are activists, part of grassroots organizations, interested in getting involved, interested in developing the tools to promote social change around a range of key issues at this conference, which takes place on March 22nd through 24th, there'll be opportunities to learn about online organizing, advocacy, campaigning, and grassroots fundraising. Sounds like a terrific offering. A lot of cool people will be there. I plan to attend as well for a couple of the days. You can find out more about that at organizing20.org. That's www.organizing20.org to attend and sign up. Finally, I have one more sort of shout out for you, and this is something we haven't really done before on Connect the Dots, but we're going to do it today. And, you know, on the show we've had different people at different times. We talk about, you know, practical actions we need to take to improve our society, but we also talk about inner work, intentions, and the larger field of consciousness in which, you know, we all manifest and participate. So one of my previous guests has been the wonderful author and dear colleague Lynn McTaggart, who's written books like The Field, The Intention Experiment, and The Bond. And so today we're going to practice a little intention experiment of our own to send positive wishes for healing to someone out on the West Coast, and so we'll just take a pause. I'll continue talking so we don't have dead air, but sending positive intentions for healing to Chris in L.A. for anyone who would like to, and you can do that now as well as throughout the day. Group intention is very powerful. That brings me to my guest for today's show. I'm so excited to have him with us. I've been reading his book, and it is simply marvelous. His name is Jerry Ellis. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, Walking the Trail, One Man's Journey Along the Cherokee Trail of Tears. He also has a new book out just recently called Cherokee History for Indian Lovers. In addition to being an author, a writer, a thinker, a screenwriter, Jerry Ellis is also a Cherokee descendant. So he'll be sharing his experience in walking the Trail of Tears with us, as well as his guiding understanding and philosophy. So welcome, Jerry, to Connect the Dots. Hi.
Good morning, Allison. Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear your voice. Of course, I've been hearing your voice on the page as I've been really enjoying your wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you.
And I know you've received many kudos and praise for it from all different quarters. You know, there's a whole, I could read the book jacket. It's filled with notables complimenting the book. It's an amazing book because it integrates, you know, it's a journey. It's a spiritual journey, but it's not just a spiritual mental journey. It's an embodied spiritual journey. It's a historical spiritual journey. It's a sacred walk that you take and document in your book, Walking the Trail. Now, let's just kind of orient our listeners a little bit to that, and then we can kind of delve into it. The book's subtitle is One Man's Journey Along the Cherokee Trail of Tears. So can you tell our listeners, you know, a little bit about the Cherokee Trail of Tears, what that is?
The Cherokee Nation was a sovereign nation in Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee and North Carolina. And in 1838, the sovereign nation was invaded by 7,000 U.S. soldiers. They were to be removed to, at the time, Indian Territory, which is present-day Oklahoma. And they were put in 16 various concentration camps throughout the states I mentioned. And I grew up in one of those towns. I'm of Cherokee heritage in North Alabama. It's where Sequoia invented the Cherokee alphabet. But when the Indians were moved after several weeks and sometimes months at these stockades for the 900-mile walk to Indian Territory, it was the heart of winter for many of them. Some had no shoes, and along the way, 4,000 died, mostly children and older people that couldn't endure. You can imagine not only the physical endurance, but what had been done to their immune system with such stress of leaving their homes and seeing those they loved die along the way. And they were buried in shallow, unmarked graves, and it became known as the Trail of Tears. So that's the thrust of what the Trail of Tears is, to oversimplify.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a tragic walk that was, you know, taken by the Cherokee people, your people, your ancestors. And when you say they were walking to Indian Territory in Oklahoma, in other words, they were taken from what had been their native lands and home, which, of course, was Indian Territory. And then they were marched in this inhumane manner to Oklahoma, which had been kind of defined by the United States government as being Indian Territory, as in, this is where we will allow the Indians to reside. In other words, does that sum it up? Kind of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we can kind of look back to that period in history, the Oklahoma area, the Indian Territory at the time, was basically the frontier. Mm-hmm. It was somewhat no man's land, and it was land that the growing United States on the East Coast, moving slowly westward, was considered land that no one would want. I might point out to your listeners that the Cherokee Nation at this time in history in 1838 was in some ways very sophisticated. A Sequoia, who lived here just a mile from where I'm speaking right now, had invented the Cherokee syllabary or alphabet and had revolutionized the written language. They had their own printing press just 50 miles over the mountain from where I sit right now. And the Cherokee Phoenix, their newspaper, was published both in Cherokee and English. And it not only addressed politics, it addressed culture, philosophy, and the education system was growing by leaps and bounds, and that frightened the encroaching non-Indians, because the Cherokee were gaining great power. And also in the 1820s, on Cherokee land and Cherokee Nation, remember, it was a sovereign nation, gold had been discovered, and this right here gave them gold fever, and there was more and more pressure put on Washington at the time to get rid of the Indians. But one quick historical note that's a pivotal note: when Thomas Jefferson, as wondrous a man as he may have been, when he did the Louisiana Purchase that would ultimately incorporate approximately 15 states in current USA, there was a clause in there made with agreement with Georgia that at a, quote, a reasonable time, the Indians would be moved west of the Mississippi. And with the printing press and discovery of gold and more whites coming in to take over the Cherokee land, these things culminated in that clause being called upon, and thus the forced removal.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, here, so I just can't help but reflect upon this. It's so incredibly ironic that today, you know, there is this kind of ugly battle about who can cross the border and come to this country and belong, be given a place, be a citizen here. And yet when the people who are, you know, the forebears of the people who are having those kinds of discussions came to this country, they really came as invaders, failing to respect and honor and seeking to displace and override the First Nation peoples whose country, you know, who, I mean, they didn't own the nation in the same way that we think of today, but this was their, the land that they belonged to and honored and all of that.
Yeah, you know, I might point out one thing without, we'll do as you choose, of course. By the way, I'm grateful to be on your show and to have access to your listeners. I might point out one thing in regards to the immigrants coming in, if we could focus just south of the border for the moment. Mm-hmm. Something that a lot of people don't fully recognize is the people coming up from Mexico and Guatemala are indigenous people, many of them, even though they have Spanish blood. Some of them are actually pure indigenous people. I speak Spanish very comfortably, and mm-hmm. there are quite a few Indians of Mayan descent in the area mm-hmm. that people brand as Hispanics. Mm-hmm. And it's something that caught up on all the polarizations about immigration and all that sometimes people don't realize these are indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And back to the invasion of the Cherokee Nation, they were certainly indigenous people, though by the time of 1838, about as a generalization, at least half of the Cherokee were mixed bloods. They particularly had intermarried and interbred with the Scots that came over from the late 1690s on over to trade with the Indians. And there were various connections, the German, the French, and the English, but particularly the Scots. So there were many mixed bloods. But I find that in my own personal point of view and observation as kind of an anthropologist, writer, sociologist, that people in today's world don't even though ironically some people have great a bond with their Indian heritage and the idea of indigenous people, American Indian, and the romance of it, they don't fully perceive that so many people coming from the South are indigenous people too. And it's certainly a contradiction, as you pointed out a moment ago, to to what this country was supposedly initially founded upon.
Thank you for that. That's a fantastic and very important insight. So, you know, being indigenous, being of the land in that way is a commonality that doesn't recognize, or for whom these kind of governmental border arrangements, it's more of a unifier among those who are indigenous or who have connection to that than it is, you know, well, I'm this tribe and you're that tribe. There's a unifying aspect there. Do you know, because I don't, as, you know, you may have looked into this, because I can, you know, I know from the book and also from our conversation here the depth and thoroughness of your investigation. What does indigenous mean exactly? I mean, do you know what, you know, how would you define it? I'd just be interested to hear you define it. I know we can look it up in a dictionary and everything, but...
The first known people of the land... Mm-hmm. That's what I would call it. Yeah, the first known people of the land. And then that gets into all kind of things, doesn't it? You know, the archaeological DNA of people coming supposedly over the Bering Strait from Asia and then down into here, and you know that's the primary a theory that how the Indians got here. They moved on south into Central and South America. And all of that, but the land. Since we're speaking of the land, I might point out if we can begin to perceive and imagine those of us who have any real connection to the land beyond the cliche. If you can begin to imagine people for time eternal, as far as they perceived it, the Cherokee, growing up in their area where their ancestors were buried and all the mythologies and their beliefs, they truly were one with nature. You know, it sounds almost corny, but I mean, everything they lived upon was initially from stones and animals, birds and plants. And this was their great spirit or their God and how they lived. So it's to be removed from that. Not only their childhood memories, but the ancestral memories of all the stories they had been told and the graves of where they had seen their grandparents be buried. It's somewhat like to have that taken from one is like imagine your spouse or your dearest friend or whatever, or a child being immediately taken from you. Handcuffed, so to speak, and removed, for you'll never see them again. You have memories, but memory is highly secondary to be able to touch and feel and smell and all the senses that give us a sense of oneness as best we can in a society. I wanted to walk the Trail of Tears for a couple of reasons, and I wanted to walk the land, and I did it in reverse from Oklahoma back to where I was born and raised in Fort Payne, Alabama, which is one of the stockades, and it gets its name. I wanted to do it in reverse for a couple of reasons. I'd spent a life on the road from early on, traveling all of North America, and I always had a wanderlust. So having done that from the age of 17, I ran away to New York when I was 17 from Alabama, so it began a lifelong a love of the road. I knew as I got older, I was 41 when I walked the Trail of Tears. I knew the immense importance of home. And also, I had been living in Hollywood prior to Dances with Wolves. That would create that great interest and trend for several years in Native Americans. It's resurging, by the way, in such places as Native American Encyclopedia. It's a huge site on Facebook and other Native American sites. I had been in Hollywood trying to sell a screenplay about a man who walked the Trail of Tears to, in reverse, to metaphorically bring home the spirits of those who had died on the trail, metaphorically. Mm-hmm. And no one in Hollywood wanted it. Once again, before Dances with Wolves, it says, you know, interesting history, the writing's good, but no one cares about the American Indian. So really had a cathartic moment there. I was down and out, depressed. No one cared about me, my heritage. So I decided, literally, I was the man in the script. You know, that that expression. Sometimes we write our own scripts in life. Mm-hmm. You know, we lay out our pathway before us, our vision. Mm-hmm. But it truly was a cathartic moment, and I decided, well, then it's me. I will sell what I have, and which wasn't a lot enough to finance the trip. So then I took a bus to Oklahoma and started the long walk after I spent several days with the Indians there in Tahlequah, current capital of the Cherokee Nations, where the Trail of Tears ended. Mm-hmm. And that began, not knowing what was going to happen or how Americans would feel about it, but that began, it turned out from the unknown into a tremendous odyssey of embracing the American stories along the way, with or without Indian bloods. And it was amazing, as you know from reading the book, how people identified with the archetypal pilgrim, the man on a mission, and also specifically what it is. So people really opened up their hearts and souls, and that's part of what I was looking for. What are the attitudes of America today?
One of the attitudes of America today is, you were sort of trying to get beneath you know, sort of the surface daily preoccupations and the things that, you know, separate people, to kind of a deeper core that, you know, to see if it's still there in the land. I mean,
yeah, precisely, very perceptive. Mm-hmm. People identifying with me as an adventurer, as a man on a mission. Mm-hmm. People identifying with the tragedy of what happened on the Trail of Tears. It was amazing. Whereas I'm talking a bit today due to the situation, when I did the 900-mile walk, once I was able to disarm people, which was quick, they were very empathetic to me, a man on a mission with a pack on his back walking, mm-hmm. you know, 900 miles. They began to open up to me, yeah, and they wanted to tell their stories. People are so hungry to tell their stories. And it was such a juxtaposition to having lived in L.A., the hustle bustle and make a buck, make a name for yourself type world, and in some cases, to people, what we might call the common folks of the land, from all aspects of life, to wanting to open up to me and tell me their own personal tragedies as well as their own joys. So this began to weave a tapestry interleaking with what happened to the Cherokee, and then the people's own stories, and that's what makes the weave of the book interwoven with history and mythology. It becomes truly an odyssey, because it was a hands-on experience to see what is America like today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one of the things that I, you know, it's very obvious in reading the book, and yet it's rare. It's the kind of thing that you don't always find, is that, you know, and I say this as one who blogs and does a lot of things on Facebook and does stuff on the internet, but, I mean, this, you know, so there's a lot of writing and a lot of communication that goes on, and I don't want to minimize it since I do it myself, and it's, you know, and I think it's important and useful, but it's right. on a different level. It's not rooted in and embodied in everyday reality. It's not rooted in the texture of one's moment by moment sensory experience and heart-centered experience of people and places, and just even the changing texture and lights and sounds of you know, what is here on earth, and your book really embodies that in I guess what I would call a very integral way. And for me personally, that really is what makes it such a an exceptional experience, because you are able to capture and share that. I mean, one could lecture endlessly about, you know, some of these things as issues, but it's very different to really live them out. And you know, you have the capacity to do that as a writer. I mean, one of the things that struck me in what you said, too, is that is the, you know, the wrenching that occurs when people have to leave their ancestry, when they lose a sense of belonging, when they lose their rootedness to the place where they and their people came from. And yet, and yet in America, really, you know, people, everyone is supposed to be self-invented. You know, people don't look back or honor their roots. They regard themselves as self-created. They can become anything they think they want to be, without reference to where they came from. If where they came from has pain or sadness, they cut off from it. This seems like a very different value set.
I think one of the things that there is an immediacy when one takes a journey and there's an intimacy and conversation. And though I slept in the woods and the meadows, mostly in a little tent every night, occasionally people would put me up to go into their homes and they feed me a place to take a shower and hear their stories and everything. You were talking, there's an intimacy there. And I think there's an intimacy in oneself, if they can find it, and the clarity of their mind and the depth of their soul, and that is tied to the roots, a couple of things. Yes, one may become inventive in today's very complex world, but, you know, we're never away from a couple of major forces, and one is really the DNA within us. I do believe, as Jung and others suggest, that things are passed on. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a collective consciousness going back to who knows how far. And there also something that people forget, I think, often is if one thinks of his mother or father or the grandfathers, grandmothers, you know, we all know we pick up certain characteristics, certain body gestures, certain tones, even laughter. We pick up what's more important. We pick up often the values of our parents and our grandparents. I think we have to keep in mind we resonate on a daily basis to some unknown extent the generations before us. And I think in our hustle bustle, as we can be inventive and we can do our own thing and, you know, follow the American dream and all those cliches, I think to deny that we are not resonating in a very down-to-earth way what's been passed on to us that goes back 100, 200, 1,000 years to some extent, I think we lose, frankly, a oneness within ourselves and a better understanding and appreciation that, you know, we all know we're just passing through. And if we're aware of some of these influences, I think it gives us more of a sense of wholeness, more of a sense of awareness of who we are, that we have our individuality. But as the cliche goes, and that's why it lives, it has truth in it, if we deny our past, I wonder if we don't cut ourselves off from a source of richness and power to better understand who we are in this world. And that's part of what I was looking at when I walked the Trail of Tears.
That makes a lot of sense. We have a caller who would like to say something or ask a question.
Sure.
So, hello, caller, speak to us.
My name is Kathy Britton. That's great, great, great grandmother.
Okay.
Last known survivor from the Trail of Tears. I honor her history.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask him, why does he say he asked Mr. Margaret he entered the Trail of Tears in his next book? How could she, when she was born in 1846 and the Trail of Tears was 1839?
I couldn't quite hear your caller.
I couldn't quite get that. You know what? We're going to thank you so much, Kathy, for your question. We're having a little technical difficulty hearing, so I'm going to ask the engineers to chat with you offline and see if they can kind of figure out your question, and then they'll convey it to me, and I will ask it of Jerry. Actually, we're going to come up on our break here, too, so we'll come back to your question after our break. Please stay with us, listeners, through this break for station identification on Connect the Dots. I'm talking with Jerry Ellis today, and this is Allison Rose Levy. We're going to continue the conversation after this break. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. Today we're talking with Jerry Ellis about his book, Walking the Trail, One Man's Journey Along the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and, of course, a whole bunch of other questions about the values, resonances, and experience embedded in the journey that he took, walking 900 miles, to retrace the steps and actually return home in the homeward direction that had been taken many years ago when the Cherokee peoples were displaced and sort of force-marched from their native areas over to Oklahoma. And Jerry did a return journey, metaphorically bringing their spirits back home. So we're talking about that and all that devolves from it. We're going to pursue getting that question asked if we can. But meanwhile, you were speaking about the fact, I think one of the things that's so incredible about the book is that the book itself and the experience resonates with what you shared, which is the experience of connection to the land and the ancestry, you know, not because you're kind of going out to sort of hike around necessarily to explore, but you're how would you characterize the kind of exploration that you do? One of the things that you said in the first part of the show is that you've always had a love for the road. You know, what is that exploration? Where do those journeys take you, such as the one in this book? Why do you think that called to you to do that in this life so much?
Well, backing up to after I ran at the age of 17, I literally ran away to New York City. I was there for 2 weeks. Had a sister living there. And I had grown up in this little mountain town where I began to feel that I was suffocating, that I wanted to learn more about the world, myself. As a kid, you know, you're 17, you want to have adventures. What it did, though, it going successfully hitchhiking to New York and back to Alabama, it gave me the understanding there was a very big world out there. I mean, coming out of a tiny town into New York City, I absolutely loved it. I loved seeing the different ways people dressed. I loved hearing the different languages. And hitchhiking, I loved. There was, however limited it was, there was a bond set up with me and the people that would give me rides, and they began to tell me stories about their life, you know, some in depth, some bits and pieces. But what it did, it set a pattern for me that I knew there was adventure out there to learn about the world. And by the age of 26, even though I went to the university and did some graduate school out in Oklahoma, by the age of 26, I'd hitchhiked enough miles to, if you put the miles together, to circle the earth 5 times. And these stories began to accumulate in me, and hopefully some sense of awareness. And I wanted to see if I could start to make sense of the human condition, that I was seeing the pattern. What connected us, you know, your shows connect the dots, you know, we as unique as we each may be, we are surely bound in some ways by the human condition, what makes us human. And I started off with a couple of short stories to major magazines in New York, had a couple plays produced. And for years, though, I didn't write. I just traveled. I just wanted the experience. And then as I got older, which is typical for that stage, in the late 30s, I felt like I had not accomplished anything with any talent I might have. And that's when I put together the script about the man who walked the Trail of Tears. And then took it to Hollywood and tried to get it produced. No one wanted it. So the trail to have some meaning and purpose and substance all those years on the road and wanting to do something I felt was of importance, not just to me, but perhaps to many other people, it led me to walk the Trail of Tears, to feel like there was something that I could relate about humanity and about the Cherokee in particular, and how people along that route would identify, if they did, and they did, with human tragedy, and also the spirit to continue, the spirit of strength, because not only with me walking it and being blessed to make the journey, but also the Cherokee, those that survived. So there's the dichotomy in there, the tragedy and the sorrow, but also there's the strong human spirit to continue to survive and try to thrive. So I think that particular book about walking the Trail of Tears that Delacorte Press had nominated for a Pulitzer, I think the timing was just right in my life personally and that time in American history where people needed to look at both something tragic but also something full of hope and belief. And I think that's why the book has reached so many readers today, because they identify with both those. And I guess the recurring thing that most readers tell me is I feel like I'm right there beside you every step of the way. So they're armchairs or coffee shops or laying in bed reading the book or wherever they are. I think they get to take that odyssey with me, and yet have the safety, of not actually doing it, but having the sense that they're there with me.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, I would definitely second that, one of the things that you mentioned there is, you mentioned tragedy and suffering and how we come to terms with it and what happens, to us when we don't come to terms with it. And so in a sense, the walk you took is an effort to come to terms. I mean, with things. I mean, there's very much a tendency, I think, that people have when something bad happens. It's too painful to deal with. They kind of just turn away from it, and we lose an opportunity when we do that. What does it take to kind of help us heal from these kinds of events that are? I mean, it's embodied by the Trail of Tears, and it's present, throughout human history in many different ways and ongoing today.
Yeah. Well, in my particular case, of course, what I did, it culminated in me actually doing the walk, which wasn't just a walk. It was the combination of the mental, the physical, mm-hmm. the spiritual. To have a goal, to have a quest, and we're for 2 months as I was doing the 900-mile walk and was constantly thinking, feeling, and interacting with people, sometimes on a very intimate verbal level where they would open up to me. I was, as the saying goes, I was something of a vessel to where people in that unique situation for me and them to pour their sorrow and their openness into my vessel that was letting them release some of their own pain and sorrow, because I heard a lot about pain and sorrow in their own personal lives. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be the vessel for them to pour it into. And of course, for me specifically, I had many, many, many hours and nights. Of course, I almost always was alone. I was sleeping in fields and in the woods. And So I had plenty of time to think and feel things. So it was like if the fire was me, if I was the fire retracing a historical route to try to find more about myself and my ancestors and humanity, and then every person I met, or many of the people I met, they were putting a stick of wood on that fire to make it blaze higher. Mm-hmm. And does that make any sense? They were contributing to the whole. You know, I wasn't commissioned to write the book. I hoped a book would come out of it. I took photographs back when we were still using, before the digital became in common day use. And of course I kept a journal. There was no assurance, that a publisher would even want the book. I mean, I had not spoken to any publishers or agents about it, and I'd sold everything I owned to give me enough money to make the trip, you know, and it seemed like, you know, the gods were with me. It just, the book was easy to write. It clicked, and it just one of those rare cases where it seemed like everything was meant to be, and it was almost overwhelming to the hundreds and hundreds of letters prior to Facebook and email they were coming in. And it was just wondrous to see people feeling that perhaps I'd been able to put into words what they sometimes had felt, or new experiences obviously they had not had, to feel a sense of identity, not only with me, the Cherokee humanity, but within themselves, that things had been spoken, they had been wanting to speak themselves, and but had not come to words to do it about something that had happened in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, yeah. And also, it's when you kind of open up in that way to your own heritage, then
yes.
People connect to their own experiences as well. We actually have, we're going to try that call again, and actually we have two callers, so we'll try
okay.
a couple of calls back to back. Okay, let's hear from our first caller. See if we have a better connection. That's Kathy. Kathy, can
yep,
we hear
I'm
from
here.
You?
Here.
Okay, great. Oh, this is a much better connection.
Yep.
And your question is?
I would like to know which one of your ancestors are you honoring on the Trail of Tears?
I look at it collectively as Cherokee people.
But how? You do not have any Cherokee history.
Well, that's just simply not the case.
That is simply the case. Your new book has the cover of Margaret E. Painter. She is not Cherokee. She did not walk the Trail of Tears. She was born in 1846. The Trail of Tears was 1839. Her father was born in 1814 in DeKalb, Alabama. So how can you be Cherokee?
You know,
you're not.
You know, Kathy, I'm going to intervene here because, you know,
well, my great-grandmother is the last survivor from the Trail of Tears, and this
okay.
hurts me greatly to have somebody who is not even a member of our tribe try to tell something about my family history.
You know, Kathy, I would say I honor you, and I'm sure Jerry does too, for your family's suffering and what your grandmother went through, and so I think we can just honor that, and thank you for calling in and sharing
well,
your feeling of suffering.
Well, he needs to not be making money off of our ancestors.
You know,
point
I don't think this
story.
Is the place to really be
well,
asking
can't
for
him any other way,
genealogical bona fides. I mean, I
so
think
he needs to go to his conscience and think about it, and I appreciate you letting me talk, and thank you very much.
All right,
Ms.
thank
Cindy.
You, Kathy, thank and we you know, send you... you know, good wishes for you and your ancestors. Thank you.
And Allison, thank you for showing insight and sophistication to this. I don't know who this person is. They're misinformed about, first of all, the name of my great-grandmother, and I know my heritage, and it's, I think, you know, thank you for showing sophistication in this. It's just the best way to handle it when people are troubled over things I have no insight into.
Well, you know, it's kind of like, it's not a, how shall I say this? You know, this is, we can't do a complex genealogy right now on the show. The fact that you felt moved to do this and went through what was physically and spiritually and psychologically demanding thing to do to honor, you know, we're not getting down to analyzing drops of blood or whatever. I think there's room and place for the to honor everybody who through, you know, their ancestry on either side. In fact, I would say that those who displaced the people also belong to this story.
Absolutely.
You know, so, and not that we honor their behavior, but, you know, there are many people who are connected to this tragic episode, and, you know, they all have a place in it, so it's not like it's just one person's place.
Yeah,
they should
exactly.
own that. Yeah.
Sure. As I pointed out earlier, by the time of the Trail of Tears, approximately half of the Cherokee were mixed bloods, and
mm-hmm.
there were thousands of people that were mixed bloods that stayed behind, and their relatives would have been moved on the Trail of Tears, and there were some along the routes and going to Oklahoma that escaped and came back and hid, and then there were some after they got to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory, they returned to their homeland. And in my area, where I was born and raised, where Sequoia invented the Cherokee alphabet, there are thousands of people that have Cherokee heritage, and it really disturbs me a little bit when this is very rare. The caller, this book has been out. The Pulitzer Prize nominated book has been out for 20 years now. I've spoken at the Cherokee Nation and everything, and it's very rare to see that kind of attitude, and it's really sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not rare for me to see that kind of attitude. I mean, not in terms of the Cherokee specifically, but
people in general. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think that also when. It really goes to the question we were discussing before the call, which is how do we heal when there has been tremendous suffering and hasn't been acknowledged? You know, so I kind of experience the caller as really seeking acknowledgement for the suffering that is still resonating within her family from
yeah.
the experience. And, you know, that is... you know, that is very understandable. Because you did the journey you did, you had the opportunity to share that experience with many, many people, and that is healing, and it's personally healing, and the book is healing for that reason. But, you know, when people sort of, you know, are in a corner of the world where they don't have that opportunity, you know, then these things are held within a person, and they can become very painful. I practice a form called ancestral repatterning that is very much about healing these kind of things. So I really
right.
do understand. And so
okay.
I think really it's about getting attention to, you know, for everybody. Now we do have another caller, if we have the courage. So let's hear from our next caller.
Well, I have a much different opinion of what you hit a very interesting point, and it's profound. We're in the process of doing a book, and we are talking about inherited knowledge. Well, you just hit that note on that. I was listening to your conversation where you actually understand the inherited knowledge that every human being has. It doesn't matter, you know, the Asians came over to this country. A lot of people died for this stuff to get inherited knowledge, and that's why we have to put back to the system. That sort of makes the tax system work, because there's thousands of, you said 200 or 1,000 years of inherited knowledge. Does that make sense to you?
It totally does to me. Yeah, and I'm thankful you picked up on that. Yeah, we're kind of resonating, aren't we, mentally, psychologically, physically, in the sense of having many in-depth qualities and characteristics passed down to us. It's you know, it's the way of the human condition.
It certainly is. Thank you, Jeff.
We have actually
another caller, Jeff, and we're getting kind of down to the...
I'm sorry.
We do have one more caller, and I just want to give everyone an opportunity to ask their question and talk with Jerry. We'll have to have you back, Jerry. A lot of people want to talk to you.
Thank you.
Do we have our next caller ready here? Let's see. Shanice,
yes.
You're from Vermont.
Hello.
Hi. What was your question?
Well, I guess I wanted to know, I haven't come across this book, and I apologize for coming to the show late, but I just wanted to know if he made the connection between the African-American experience and the Cherokee, because there are many Cherokees who are also African American, and there are African Americans who are also Cherokee, and I don't see that connection made too often, and I think it's a shame. But I applaud him, and I would love to read his book, and I'm so thankful that he's here on the show talking about his experience.
What you're saying is very true. There is note of it somewhat in my book, Walking the Trail. But I have a brand new book that's just out 2 weeks ago called Cherokee History for Indian Lovers on Kindle. And it really, goes more into, the subject matter of which you're speaking. And it has a lot of photographs and, historical photographs, obviously. The truth is, in 1989, when I walked the Trail of Tears, a lot of my journey, though there's mythology and history and nuggets interwoven into the book, it was greatly a personal journey for me that became a universal story, an archetypal story, if you follow me. Whereas having been starting to lecture on Cherokee history and culture, and particularly the book, which I've done in Asia and Africa and Europe and throughout the United States, I became far more passionate as a researcher to read all I could find about things. So this new book, Cherokee History for Indian Lovers, certainly goes into the African Cherokee connection. And you're right, there's a lot on both sides. Interbreeding, intermarrying, a small portion, less than 5% of the Cherokee had slaves, and the results of that, pros and cons. I don't whitewash the Cherokee in the new book. While most of them, as a general, the Cherokee at the time of the removal in 1838 were loving, hardworking, very poor people. There were a few rich, and they had the complexities, to put it discreetly, as any other race of people. They were, as they say, they were good Indians and they were bad Indians. And some of this in the book relates to the treatment of black slaves.
Well, that's further reading for you then, and for our other listeners. Thank you so much, Shanice, for that wonderful question. We're actually coming down to the last moments of the show here, so I just want to give a shout out to both books, Walking the Trail, One Man's Journey Along the Cherokee Trail of Tears, as well as Jerry Ellis's new book, Cherokee History for Indian Lovers. And I just want to thank you so much, Jerry, for joining me today and answering these questions and speaking with our audience here on Connect the Dots. It's been great having you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. You did a wonderful interview, and I'm thankful for all your listeners.
And I, too, want to thank you, listeners, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. If you missed any portion of the show, you can go to our archives, or if you think friends would be interested, please send that along with them on the Progressive Radio Connect the Dots archives, and like the show on iTunes, and stay with us next week. Tune in for another edition of Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Eastern Time every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network. In future weeks, we're going to have Helen Caldicott, plus the author of a book about pollution in Tom's River. Every week, we cover these kinds of things. So see you next week, listeners.